WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Have you ever found yourself cutting corners on basic needs to afford that luxury that you just can't live without? Does the pocket you carry your iPhone in have a hole in it? Luxury items have always been a sign of affluence and of status, but are they really a clear indicator of wealth, especially in this fluctuating economy? Well, Virginia Postrel has written about this in the Atlantic Monthly, including the idea that the luxury items we choose vary by race and class. You may know Virginia Postrel from Reason Magazine. She's now a contributing editor and columnist for the Atlantic. Hi, Virginia. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thank you very much.
And you start your piece with this observation that African Americans not only have less wealth than whites with similar incomes, they also had significantly more of their assets tied up in cars. Why is that important?
Yes, well, this particular insight came up when a couple of economists that I write about, Kerwin Charles and Eric Hurst, were studying the wealth gap, which is the idea that black and white households that have the same income seem to have a difference in assets. And they noticed this idea that, African Americans seem to have more of their wealth tied up in cars, which fits an old stereotype and wasn't directly relevant to the research they were doing back then. But then later on, more recently, they went back to this and said, well, okay, what's going on here? Is this just some kind of, you know, ethnic preference that just blacks like cars more than whites do or something like that? And what they found was something that has implications that go far beyond race, which is that if you look at the statistics and you dig down into it, what you find is that people who are from a less affluent peer group, in this case, they looked at your racial group in your state. So, say, blacks in California, whites in Mississippi, whites in California, blacks in Mississippi. Is there? If your peer group, the people that, somebody passing you on the street might lump you in with, is poorer, you're more afraid of being thought poor than if your peer group is richer, and therefore you tend to spend a greater percentage of your total income on things that show up, on things that a stranger on the street might see, your cars, your jewelry, your clothes.
And as you become actually more affluent, you tend to maybe not buy as many show-offy things.
It's a little trickier than that.
Yeah.
It's a little trickier. If you belong to a poor peer group, as you become more affluent and have more money to spend on these things, you will spend more money on these outwardly visible, conspicuous consumption things. Mm-hmm. You as an individual become richer.
Right, based on your
peer
group.
As the peer group is still poor. As your peer group becomes richer as a group, all of you will spend sort of less on average on these visible things, which is what, I mean, if you think about the United States as a peer group, let's leave aside regional differences or racial differences, ethnic differences.
Mm-hmm.
People do spend less as a percentage of their income on clothes, cars, jewelry, visible items.
More things for their
than they did, say, 50 years ago.
Right. So as one source you quote says, if you want to live like a billionaire, and I guess the implication is if you want to live like a billionaire who hangs out around billionaires, then buy a $12,000 bed.
Right, right.
Right. But actually, I don't know how much I think this actually holds, because if you look at the most obvious thing that people own that probably varies tremendously by income group, it's the home.
Yes, and the home was not included in this. There are a number of reasons that it's difficult to track to look at that. And also, they were really looking at things that, if you think about your home, most people that you will pass on the street have no idea what your home looks like. And this really gets to what goes beyond the economic research here, but is an observation that seems to hold, which is that really it's not so simple to talk about conspicuous consumption, visible consumption, things that people who pass you on the street can see, versus invisible consumption.
Right, and
it's really a continuum.
Yeah, and if you live in a gated community in a $12 million home, I guess the average person on the street isn't going to see it. They're going to see what kind of suit you wear and jewelry you wear and things like that, and
right.
car you drive.
Or if you live in a modest apartment, or you live in a, you know, average suburban house or whatever it is, people on the street won't see it.
So you describe
people
some
in your neighborhood will know. Maybe your colleagues at work might have some idea.
Okay.
And certainly your friends will know.
So you've described this difference that research finds. Is there an underlying value judgment here? I mean, Bill Cosby famously criticized African Americans for buying $500 sneakers instead of educational toys for their kids. Are you making a value judgment or reporting on one?
I don't think that this is really a value judgment. It is a statement about how human beings tend to behave. And by the way, there is international, if not data than observations, that this is also the case, which is why you see if you're the luxury good manufacturers are all looking to sell in Russia and China.
Right. Let me linger on that for a minute, because that was a fascinating aspect of the article, that China and Russia, two recently poor and yet upwardly mobile countries, are now the hottest markets for luxury goods. What does that tell us?
Well, one thing it tells us, of course, is that they're just expanding what they spend on everything. But the other thing it tells us is that if you are a little more affluent in a poor country like that, you want to make sure everybody knows it. And I guess the insofar as there's a value judgment, it's really that this kind of very visible conspicuous consumption is a sign of insecurity, of being worried about a stigma. Now, that's not a value judgment in the sense of saying that you're bad to be worried about that, but it's an unfortunate case. It's unfortunate that people feel that that pressure, as opposed to being able to spend either on, you know, things that might be better for them in the long run, such as education, or just on things that maybe they would enjoy more. You know, maybe they would, rather than spending a lot on their car, they would rather spend a lot on their TV, which is you know, equally frivolous, I suppose you could say, but is not as visible to the outside world.
So this is in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Is the fact that you wrote this now related to the economic downturn and its implications for Americans' lives?
Well, I think you can... you can suggest some advice that might come out of it, one of which is that, you know, perhaps you might look to see whether you're engaging in this behavior, whether you are worried about being poor, being thought poor, and maybe spending money in places that you needn't spend them. But this is a long-term pattern that doesn't vary with recessions or the specific conditions of the economy at any particular moment.
I guess I was wondering, you know, if the first things on the additional shopping list vary by race and class and peer group, does the first thing off the shopping list also vary when times get tough?
Well, it may be, you know, people are, they say that, you know, Starbucks is having trouble. So maybe those kinds of less visible little consumer indulgences that are mostly pleasures for yourself go away because they seem not only frivolous, something you could substitute something to home for, but also they don't necessarily convey any kind of status to them.
Yeah. Is this, before you go, is this kind of, same as it ever was? There's just a different incarnation for today of the nouveau riche or nouveau upper working class? Or
no,
is there something really new here?
No, I think this really is same as it ever was. This really, and in fact, the research I report on only goes back a few like 20 years or so, but I think it explains a lot about why in the 1950s, for example, there was such a tremendous emphasis on, having the latest car, everybody, getting a new car every year, and this kind of very visible consumption. Because think about the country at that time. We were, there was a growth period, but we were not that long away from the Great Depression. A lot of people were hitting the middle class for the first time in their families, and there was a real sense of you didn't want to be thought poor. It was a sort of a stigma, and you want to keep up with the Joneses, as they said. And I think that explains a lot of what's going on. Is what it really is about not so much being thought rich as not being thought poor. And the less chance there is that people will look at your spending and think that you're somehow poor, not that there ought to be anything wrong with being poor per se, but there is this sort of status hierarchy, the less likely it is that people will think that you're poor just because you don't have a new car, the less likely it is that you'll feel pressure to buy one when you don't necessarily want one.
Virginia Postrel, contributing editor and columnist for The Atlantic Monthly, her article in the July-August edition called Inconspicuous Consumption. Virginia, thanks a lot.